You're listening to the Converging Paths podcast, brought to you by Barakat Trust, with the support of the Al Tajir Trust and the Aga Khan Trust for Culture.
Hello, everyone. This is Saifa Rashidi from the Barakat Trust. It's a great pleasure to welcome Konstantinos Politis, one of our recent grantees and a very eminent archaeologist of the Middle East. Hi, Konstantinos. How are you?
Fine. Thank you very much for having me, as they say.
No, it's a pleasure. And I wondered if you could tell us about the project that you're working on in Greece, what it is and its location.
Yes. We began this project about 3 years ago, just before, well, just after kind of the COVID situation. And I had this idea to look at the town where my family's from, which was actually a fairly important medieval period town. Was also quite important in the classical Greek history. But there's been quite a bit of work done on these periods in the town center. But I had the idea to look at the hinterland. In other words, what supported economically and politically, but more economically, this town of relatively important historical significance.
So can you tell us the name of the town and also place it geographically so that our listeners can understand where it is and what it is?
Of course, of course. The town is called, the modern name is Halkida. The ancient classical name is Halkis, but it was known in the medieval period as Egribos because of the Straits of Evripos, but also Negroponte by the Italian Venetians and by the Ottoman Turks as Agribos. It's located right on the straits between the mainland and the island of Evia, or classical Euboea. Now, Evia is also not a very well-known island, but it happens to be the second biggest island in Greece, and I think the seventh or sixth in the Mediterranean. So a fairly big island located just on the eastern side of Attica and Athens. Many people don't even see it as an island because there are land bridges. There were ancient land bridges and there are modern land bridges. But what it does is kind of represent, or not represent, but kind of it looks towards the east, but at the same time is very close to the mainland Greece. So it's been strategic throughout history.
Okay, and can you tell us in what way it's been strategic and why it's an important location?
Yeah, it's probably important to look at a map to understand, but it's a long island and it goes from north to south from the town and Bay of Volos in Greece, all the way down to Attica, all stretching all the way down to the edge of Attica where Athens is located. But the straits are very narrow, and if you want to go from the south of the Aegean, let's say from Greek Peloponnese or Athens, to the north and come out to the north Aegean and go straight to Constantinople, Istanbul, you can do this quicker and secretly because you can't see from the east ships crossing this very narrow straits of Egribos. I'll begin with prehistory, well, proto-history, the whole story of Troy and the Mycenaean, the Greek Mycenaeans gathered in this bay of ancient Halkis and went through the straits and went straight up past the Bay of Volos, straight up to Troy, relatively unnoticed. So I'm trying to highlight how important strategically it is in history for moving your ships from the south Aegean, from the Mediterranean to the north. It was also in reverse when the Persians came into Greece in the classical period and attacked Marathon and Athens. They went in through northern Evia, through this very let's say secret or unprotected northern part of Evia. So the island of Evia is strategic for its location, and this is why in the medieval period it also continued to be important and prospered.
Wow, that's fascinating. Does that mean that the people that controlled it had forts and other defenses to make sure that anyone that passed through by only upon their consent? I mean, how was it monitored and controlled?
Indeed, whoever had the town or city, really, of Chalcis or Agrippos or Negroponte, whoever controlled that, controlled this passage from the south to the north, whether it was, you know, in ancient Greek times or in medieval Venetian and Ottoman period, which we're looking at. So the Ottomans, to give you an idea how important it was, after Mehmet II took Istanbul, Constantinople, he went down to this town. This is like the second place he took. He realized if you wanted to control strategically the Aegean, you know, both east and west sides, both, you know, what is modern Turkey and modern Greece, you need to control this passage, this Straits of Agrippos or Chalcis. So the Ottomans recognized this. Earlier, the Venetians recognized the importance of the town, and it was the third most important outpost of the Venetians, Venice, Crete, or Candia, and Negroponte. So it's been consistently strategically important.
Thanks. And when was it important to the Venetians and then to the Ottomans? I mean, what kind of time period are we talking about?
Yeah, we're looking at when the Crusaders took Constantinople and a lot of the Eastern Mediterranean and ravaged the East Mediterranean. Probably they were the people that destroyed most. They also spent a winter there and also took over this town of Agrippos. The Ottomans and the Venetians obviously recognized this as important, but following the Crusaders, the Venetians established an outpost there, fortified this passageway and created this town. The Ottomans then, a bit later, took it. Mehmet II took it. So in the medieval period, from the 13th, from the Crusader period, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th century, up until the Ottomans took it, it continued up until the modern period when it was became part of the Greek state.
Thanks. And you mentioned your interest in the local economy and trade, etc. Can you tell us, I mean, I suppose it was also an important entrepot for trade, and what would have been traded through it or from that city?
Well, the Venetians were known to be great traders, and they were interested in this place because it was the gateway for them, or at least it was the it was the kind of gateway to the east. So all their trading networks with Anatolia, modern Turkey, or the Near East, and indeed even south in Palestine and Egypt, they used this along with Crete, which is of course even more important, as their eastern outposts for trade. Now the island of Euboea or Negroponte, which is the same name as the town for the Venetians, happens to have flowing rivers, wood, a lot of forests, good agriculture, but also mineral deposits of iron ores, of very good marbles, and other types of natural resources. So both in ancient times and in medieval periods, it was, the island itself was very self-sustaining. So for the Venetians, it was a self-sustaining island or part of the Venetian period. And the Ottomans, of course, wanted this for similar reasons, because it was wealthy in its natural resources.
So it's both strategic in terms of geographically and in terms of controlling movement, but also rich in its own right.
Yes. To highlight this, the Ottomans not only built a port there, but it was their naval base for the Aegean. And what followed for the Ottomans, they made it the capital. It was actually the capital, the Sanjak, of mainland Greece and the Aegean. So the Turks upgraded it, even though the Venetians in the 13th, 14th, 15th century had this as a very important port base for Eastern trade. The Ottomans continued this and upgraded it.
And I'd be really interested to find out more about your project and what you're actually doing in Halkida. So could you just give us a bit of background about what you're trying to find out about its history, how, and also what you found out so far?
Our current project focuses on this medieval period, which is Venetian and Ottoman, largely Ottoman, up until the creation of the Greek state in the 19th century. And we're focusing not on the town itself, but on its hinterland. But by extension, of course, we have to understand why the town or the city was so important. And it was strategic, as I said, but it also had this agricultural wealth. And what we're looking at is what products, a variety of agricultural products. And because with support of the Barakat Trust, we've been able to read the Ottoman documents, we have a very long list, dozens of agricultural products that were produced in the hinterland, which supported the town. So we're understanding the agricultural economy and consequently the economy of this town, which along with its strategic position, made it the capital of the Aegean for the Ottoman medieval period.
Thanks. And can you tell us a bit, I mean, what kind of agriculture did you find? What did the archives reveal to you?
Well, a long list of, you know, classic, you know, East Mediterranean type of products, such as, you know, olive and wheat was grown on the mainland side, but very important. And in fact, there were mills. We had a number of Ottoman mills for flour making. But what was surprising, aside from the Mediterranean crops, you know, figs, of course, were very important, grapes. But what was surprising that we found in the Ottoman documents were dates. And, you know, we presented a lecture earlier this year to the Greek Archaeological Society, and we mentioned dates that the Ottomans would travel and they would see from the boats, they would see these olive date groves. And this is something you think of in the Arab world or the Eastern Mediterranean. But here we have this this town in Greece, this city in Greece, which was also famous for its dates. Now, we haven't been able to identify dates in our archaeological work, but some of the people we've spoken to speak about date production even in the early 20th century. So a long list of agricultural products, but also meats and, of course, fish.
That information about dates is so interesting and also very surprising. Yes. Are there any palm trees left in the hinterland, or have they all disappeared?
Well, there are some palm trees which have been transported recently into Greece, but the plants, the palm plants, because technically they're not trees, have not survived. And one of the problems with palm trunks is because they're not wood, they're not used for wood, they're fibrous, so they're not used for construction usually, and certainly not for things like boats or buildings. So they haven't survived in the as far as I know, in the archaeological record. But we are looking, what part of our project, which has been sponsored by the Castle Foundation in the UK, has been looking at wood and plaster and dating this. Now, it does not include date or palm kind of wood, but we are looking at that also, the types of wood that was used in construction of buildings and boats.
So you looked at the archives and found all this information on what it was like historically. And does that then lead you to go and look physically for the remains of, say, agricultural buildings or farm buildings? Or, I mean,
exactly.
I know you're doing a survey. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Exactly.
As well?
This is our second, we're going into our third year of looking at our surface surveys, collecting pottery and all the information we can, but also from the Ottoman records, the villages and the towns that exists in the hinterland in this area are all recorded. And the records include not only the names of the towns, but also the people and the products they produced. I mean, the Ottoman records have this fantastic wealth of information for it. So they would, let's say there was a family that would have, you know, whatever, 10 children, and they had 55 sheep, and they produced so much, you know, so much grapes and so much wheat and whatever. All that is recorded in detail in these Ottoman records. So it's a real wealth. And that's now what we're working on and, you know, looking to produce as a publication in the years to come.
And what kind of records are they? Are they tax records? And what kind of records would have such detailed information about people and what they owned and their animals and all of that?
Well, exactly. The tax records. The Ottomans were great administrators and recording of of the wealth of the population, which is for taxing purposes. They probably learned this from the Byzantines before, but it was a continuity of a detailed administration and tax collecting. Yes, taxes were the main reason where you would tax your population and what it produced. Now, you know, for instance, one interesting thing that we came up with, or that I think was interesting, is that, you know, often they say, oh, they tax the Christians, but not the Muslims. Well, we have tax records also for the Muslims. So they're not just taxing the Christians. They're also taxing a Muslim family.
And so it was one of those areas that had both Muslim and Christian communities?
Oh, certainly in the Ottoman period. I mean, in the earlier Byzantine and Venetian or Latin. We use the word Latin, not Venetian, because there were people from Catalan. There were various groups from Italy. So it's really Latins, versus, let's say, Orthodox and later Ottoman Muslims. So yes, during the Ottoman period, from the 16th century on, it was largely, or 15th century on, it was largely Ottoman Muslims population.
And I know that you've also, there's an element of involving the community in what you're doing and engaging people. And I wondered, I mean, I think that that's an interesting thing, that you're not just working with archaeologists and historians and archivists. And I wondered if you could tell us a bit about how that's been working and what has been the local response to what you're doing.
Well, we are very conscious of the identities. And today, archaeologists are looking at identities, how we interpret things. I mean, in modern Greece, they very much use the story of ancient Greece to, you know, 2,500 years ago, which is kind of out of date. You know, our identities are much closer to, let's say, the Turkish people than it is to 2,500 years ago. Some people might not like me saying that, but the reality is that we are much closer to that. And what's interesting is that history and archaeology students or academia go through phases of popularity. And right now, there's quite a lot of Greeks studying Ottoman period and learning Ottoman Greeks, Ottoman Turkish. I mean, it's not a huge number, but there are certainly dozens. And in the local community, in the beginning with our colleague, Dr. Lambrakis, who's reading the documents, the Ottoman documents, we were a little bit apprehensive, worried that maybe there might be a negative. But in fact, not at all. People are very interested in their recent Ottoman past, and they don't seem to have any problem in identifying monuments that are related to Islam. Very recently, and we'll be reporting on this to the Barakat Trust, we've identified 6 mosques in the town, one or actually 2 have survived. One survived as a church, the other survived as a mosque. But we have had no negative response, and some of the younger people that we've included now in our project are very interested. So I think we're successfully seeing this as part of our identity without any negativity.
So you actually discovered buildings or remains of buildings that exist, but people didn't know what their history was prior to their current use?
Well, traditional historians, yeah, may have had some interpretation or not good interpretation. But what we're doing now is really setting the record straight. I mean, when you have, you know, when you have a mihrab, you have a mihrab, you know, it's there. And there's a couple of instances which were kind of not really, let's say, not noticed or given much attention. But now we're highlighting this in our studies. And then we have photographs from 100-year-old photographs, which show some buildings which have now appeared, which, you know, a couple of them were mosques. Also churches have been destroyed, and also many other traditional houses. Part of the problem in Greece and many places is just modern development. But we're looking at texts, archaeology, but even photographic and maps. An important part of our study has been looking at maps from the 16th, 17th centuries on. So we're trying to use as much information as we can.
And what for someone like you, for whose family comes from this area and this region, what has been the most meaningful and rewarding thing about the project?
Well, I mean, I would love to find my family name, you know, my family being in the Ottoman tax records, but we haven't found that yet. But we do have some tombstones, a tombstone of our family that goes back 200 years during the Ottoman period. So our first relative, as far as I can see, was born during the Ottoman period. So our family was there throughout, certainly from the late Ottoman period. But there are also some documents that show the Venetian period, and our families mentioned there. The interesting connection would be to make, not just for our family, but the connection that needs to be done is between the, 15th and 17th century, because the Ottoman records from the 16th century aren't as clear and aren't as abundant, let's say, as they are later. So that period there needs more work. We've very recently, a month ago, been able to get some access to some documents, not only in the Ottoman Prime Minister's office, not office, but records, but in the Topkapi, which is very, very good for us. And we've been able to get some references, and we hope to get more from there. But there's a wealth of information there, and be great for me if I can find my family, yes.
And have you found, have any of the other people that you know or have been involved found any connections to their families?
I don't even want to say a handful. There might be a couple of families, but part of the problem is that the surnames don't necessarily survive, or they're different during the Ottoman. I mean, surnames didn't exist during the Ottoman, before the Ottoman period or before the late Ottoman period. So difficult to make the connection. But for instance, a very good friend of mine, whose surname is Soufleri, Souf. So we're saying, well, what is it? Is it Souf like wool? Was he a wool trader from the Arabic Souf? Or was he kind of Sufi? And by the way, we have found a teke in this town, which was a Sufi holy man. So we do have connections with Sufi, but perhaps this family was simply a trader of wool. But the surnames are interesting, yeah.
And the Sufi teke that you found, where I suppose was that, physically intact, or is it just that you found?
No, there is a great story about the Karababa fortress, which earlier was the Sufi holy man who had his teke there up on this Karababa. His name was Karababa. We'll be reporting this in full. It's very exciting, very interesting. There's nothing obviously there now, but we're looking at the ground. There's a church built in this Ottoman period fort, and I'm very suspicious of a couple of walls and stones which may have belonged to a teke, or a mosque also was supposed to be there. It's difficult because we can't exactly excavate there, but we're looking at as much information we can historically and bits and pieces on the ground.
Well, it sounds fascinating how you've used archives and maps and old photos and gone to find evidence and traces of things that people might not know about.
Yes. Next year, we're planning to excavate in one of the Ottoman towers. And next to it, there's a small chapel, which I suspect may have been a mosque. We'll find out what happens in August. So stay tuned.
It sounds really fascinating. Well, what excites you about this revealing all these different identities and different layers of history that create modern Greece?
Well, modern Greece is a product of multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious history. And, most modern Greeks are not direct descendants of 2,500 years ago. We may have some, in the higher education system or so, but we have very complex cultural backgrounds, which include various ethnic identities and religious identities. So what we're trying to present is exactly this, and present what is a modern Greek. But that is one of the challenges, because the narrative from 200 years ago was that we are all descendants of ancient Greece, but we're not direct descendants of one cultural ethnic identity. We're complex. We are all complex.
Well, I think it's fascinating and also very important that what you're doing is revealing the nuances of identities and histories. And it sounds like you have long-term plans for doing more of it. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. It was very interesting. And thanks, Konstantinos, for this really fascinating insight into delving into history and seeing things that perhaps have gone overlooked for many decades.
We look forward to future revelations.